The next case is 98-1475, State of Ohio versus Brett Xavier Hartman. Mr. Sugarman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Mr. Bogdanoff and Mr. Ray. My name is Irv Sugarman, along with my co-counsel Nathan Ray. We represent Brett X. Hartman in this matter. Let me begin my argument this morning by suggesting to the court that this should not have been a death penalty case. It is similar in some respects to the case that you just heard, and I'll get into that in a little bit, but the reason that this is not a death penalty case is that there was insufficient evidence to sustain the conviction for kidnapping in this case. Therefore, there should have been no kidnapping specification, therefore no aggravating circumstance, and therefore no death penalty. I rest my argument.
Why, Mr. Sugarman, was the evidence, I thought we had evidence of a significant restraint of the victim. Why do you say that would suffice?
I don't believe that there was, Justice Cook, any significant restraint that was not incidental to the underlying charge of murder. The only evidence that was presented to the court and the only evidence that is presented in the state's brief and the only evidence that was presented to the original grand jury, and we have a case here again where the state goes back in and supplements the indictment 30 days later with exactly the same evidence. There could not have been any new evidence that was presented to this grand jury for the kidnapping charge and the kidnapping specification, because at the outset the state already had its coroner's report and it already had the sole piece of evidence that it relied upon at trial and relies upon here today, which is the tying up of Winda Snipes' ankle to the bedpost. There is a long series of cases starting with State versus Logan, which actually details the history of this particular argument, which supports our conclusion here today. And in State versus Logan, which was a case that also originated out of Summit County, this court held that the appellant's detention and asportation of the victim was incidental to the crime of rape and demonstrated but a single animus. And I think that's another important issue, Justice Cook, as to why this kidnapping conviction and the kidnapping specification cannot stand, because there was no separate animus that was presented. In 1992, this case decided State versus Cook, and in an opinion that was authored by the Chief Justice, it was held that there must be significant restraint or movement, not just incident to the killing itself, which is where exactly this case relies upon. In that case, the victim was taken from the store that he managed, transported at gunpoint to a place several miles away where he was found, and the court did find, and I submit correctly so, that he was restrained of his liberty to a degree sufficient to uphold a kidnapping conviction. In the Jenkins case in 1994, this case in a unanimous decision dealt with a bank robbery case where the victims were held at gunpoint and actually told to move to the rear of the building. And the holding in that case was that the restraint or the movement of the victims was incident to the underlying circumstance. And also in 94, the Simcoe case held an opposite conclusion under some different points, where the victim was held for a half an hour at gunpoint and terrorized. And there was evidence of that was in the record. When she tried to escape and was shot in the back, the court did find that the restraint of the victim was not incidental to the murder and affirmed the conviction.
But in this case, isn't there evidence of, I don't know if you want to call it stab wounds, but at least 130 cuts? You can't do those in a very short period of time, and the evidence also seemed to be that the majority of these cuts were inflicted while she was still alive. How is that different from the half hour example you just
Well, I think that the difference is that the evidence as to the kidnapping portion, that the and again, this is based on the state's theory of the case and the state's argument in the state's brief, was that the only basis for the kidnapping was the tying of the ankle to the bedpost.
But if somebody's tied to a bedpost and being stabbed 130 times, don't you think she would be trying to get away?
Based upon the evidence that was presented by the coroner in this particular case, there was a conclusion that was reached that she could have been in the process of dying when this occurred, when the pantyhose was wrapped around her ankle.
The jury could make a reasonable inference that she was still much alive and not able to get away had she not been tied.
I suggest to you, though, that the reasonable doubt was present based on the coroner's own testimony that she was not able. And again, I think that we get down to the single animus. And I don't think that this case is any different than the Fierce case that was decided, where somebody holds somebody at gunpoint for a long period of time, even a shorter period of time. And it has been found on numerous occasions by this court that that does not involve significant restraint. We certainly don't have the asportation or the secret confinement in this particular case. I think it's a conjunctive test as well, because I think that you have to find that there is a separate animus. And based upon what the state's theory of this case was, which came from the alleged jailhouse confession that Mr. Hartman made, that he snapped when the victim here refused to have sex with him and then stabbed her repeatedly. I doesn't believe that this is a long series. It according to the state's own witnesses and the state's own argument, there was in fact this type of a snapping and this type of an anger and this type of a rage.
Regardless of the amount of time, wouldn't you agree that she was deprived of her liberty?
Well, I think in any type of a case, yes, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. But I think that the degree of liberty and the significant restraint and the fact that I do not believe that the evidence was sufficient to show that it was anything but incidental to the crime. And again, we have a situation similar to the last case where this is originally indicted as an aggravated murder case. And they go back in again 30 days later, present the same evidence, and decide for one reason or the other, and we can submit that the reason is to put more pressure on the defendant to plead, or as a result of public pressure.
Couldn't you also, from the evidence of the fact that he inflicted 130 stab wounds, that he tortured her for a considerable period of time before one of those blows actually caused her death?
I can't disagree with the fact that being stabbed 133 times is gruesome and heinous. The issue that we're bringing today is that there is enough in and of itself is enough.
If the jury chose to believe from the factual evidence that he tortured her before the fatal blow, then I mean, that's a reasonable inference from the evidence, because the wounds show that she was still alive. Dying or not dying, she was still alive.
If that's what the facts demonstrated, I would agree, but that's not what was argued in the trial court, and that's not what's argued here before this court.
Was there evidence, aside from the coroner's evidence? You're saying that we have evidence from the coroner, so the jury only knew the coroner's evidence about she was in the process of dying at the time of the restraint. Is there any contradictory evidence about in conjunction with Justice Stratton's question? Is there a reasonable inference permitted by other evidence?
No, I don't believe that there was any expert testimony that was introduced on the defense side of that particular matter. The second issue that I'd like to address today deals with the ineffective assistance of counsel, and in Proposition of Law 7, we've set forth 12 instances where we believe that counsel's performance was deficient. However, there is one in particular that I'd like to address today, because I feel that it's egregious, and I feel that it mandates a reversal and a vacation of the death penalty. At the penalty phase, the trial court gave the following instruction, which we take no issue with and which was proper, and it talked about mitigating factors. And it said, mitigating factors are factors that, while they do not justify or excuse the crime, nevertheless, in fairness and mercy, may be considered by you as reducing the degree of defendant's blame or punishment. So that is what the defense counsel's job was, is to present factors to this jury at the penalty phase which reduce the degree of the defendant's blame in this particular case. And I'm going to read to you, and I have in my brief, what defense counsel told the jury in his opening statement of the penalty phase. He stated, one, we're not trying to reduce blame because you've already determined blame. And number two, there's nothing that I can do, nothing we can say, no evidence we can put on to reduce the blame you've already ascribed. Defense counsel gave up. He went to the plate, he took the bat out of Mr. Hartman's hands, if you will. Because by telling the jury there's nothing he could do, nothing he could say, or nothing he could present to reduce the blame, this is directly contradictory to the court's instruction to the jury. And therefore, what was the purpose of this mitigation hearing?
What, did he go on then and present mitigating evidence? I mean, he did.
He did.
You think that it's that concession out front, even though he then did present, he made an effort to reduce the blame. You think the concession determines it?
That's a great question. It's interesting because I was thinking about that yesterday in preparation for this argument and whether I might get a question. Well, was this just a mistaken word? Could it be phrased it differently? And I recalled 5 or 6 years ago when I argued the Brooks case here, and I think we all learned a lesson from that case, where one word in a transcript, and in fact one letter in a transcript, can make the difference between life and death. And so therefore, when he says to the jury that I can't do anything to reduce the blame of my client, I'm going to take that statement at face value, and I think the jury took it at face value because the judge told him to take it at face value. And once this jury hears all this evidence, their response is, so what? He's already told us there's nothing he can do to reduce what the trial court told us we can't do. And in fact, and I'll reserve some time, and I'd like Mr.
That case
Rader,
was from the same county as this one, wasn't it?
That's absolutely correct. And
same fine counsel.
Yes, and I made some similar arguments at that point in time too, and at this point in time I would like to turn the podium over to my co-counsel, Mr. Ray, and reserve 5 or 6 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Sugarman. Mr. Ray.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. As Mr. Sugarman indicated, my name is Nathan Ray, and along with Mr. Sugarman, we represent Brett Hartman in this matter. What I wanted to focus on with the court this morning was proposition of law for dealing with the computer enhancement in this case of the blood stain that was, or the fingerprint that was found on the bed in the victim's home. In order to kind of get an understanding for where we're coming from here, I think we have to kind of understand what this was and what was being presented to the court or to the jury. What they were doing, they were digitally enhancing a fingerprint.
Why does that issue matter when I believe in reading the record that there was a match without the computer enhancement by the expert, correct?
I believe that there was a testimony by that witness that, yes, there was a match without it.
So without the enhancement, he found a match. And secondly, your defendant admitted to being there and admitted you would find my fingerprints there, correct?
That's correct.
Error could possibly happen, even if the person was not qualified to testify to the enhancement? How could that possibly affect the outcome of the trial?
Let me respond. My response is this. I'm not sure if the digital enhancement, if the individual who did this was from Seattle, Washington. I'm not sure if he did this, and I'm not sure if the record's clear, Your Honor, whether he was able to get a print before or after he did the latent or the digital enhancement. I'm not sure, and I'm not sure if the record's clear on that. My second thought is this. BCI Laboratories of Richfield did fingerprinting in this house also. And there was an expert from BCI Laboratories that testified in this case also. And they never indicated that they were able to pull up a fingerprint off of this bed. It's not, to go to the second portion of your question, the fact that he had been there before, the fact that his fingerprints were there, what is so, what the finding of this fingerprint is so egregious about was that, if I remember the record correctly, it was the only fingerprint that was found in the blood in the house. In other words, that would have indicated that he had been there at the time of the killing because his fingerprint was there in the bloodstain. And if I remember the record correctly, that
but
was the only...
But he testified that he moved the body and tried to clean up, and so whether he was there before or after, his own testimony puts him squarely putting his fingers in all sorts of places where there was blood.
But I believe...
I have blood on my hands, I'm cleaning up in the sink trying to wash it off, I tried to move the body. That's his own testimony.
But I think that if you look at the testimony in this case, and the way this evidence was used, if that was indeed the fact, Judge, then there would have been no need for the digital enhancement. There would have been no need in this case for the man to come in from Seattle, Washington, and testify.
But the standard we have to look at is if it was a defective proof of the counsel or abuse of discretion to allow it in, did it affect the outcome of the trial?
And I think that if the prosecutor's office had not thought that it could have affected the outcome of the trial, they would not have used it
in
this case.
How? How would it have affected the outcome of the trial? What would it have established? What point would it have made that would have made a difference in the trial?
Well, obviously, I can't give you an answer on that. The prosecutor's office were the ones that chose to do that. Obviously, they thought it was that important that they wanted to present it to the jury. Why they chose to do that and why they chose to go to that expense, I'm not sure, Judge. But obviously for them, it was that important. I'm not sure where he moved the body from, but I know that the fingerprint was found on the bed sheet of the victim in this case. And for them, it was important enough that they go to the expense and the time of trying to find someone who could present this testimony to the court or to the jury. What they failed to do under Daubert and Komeko out of the U.S. Supreme Court was establish that there was a proper foundation for this evidence to come in. And I think that the U.S. Supreme Court has established a number of factors that the trial court is to look at in determining whether or not this evidence is to come in. And the trial court did not do that in this case. It simply failed to look at this as scientific evidence.
Did your client ever change his story, say I wasn't there?
I don't think that Mr. Hartman ever changed his story and said he was not there. I know he did say, and he has continued to say, that he did not do this crime. And I think that that was probably why the government or the state felt this was so important to bring this in, because they found his fingerprint on the bed of where the victim had been. I think that under Daubert, where you have the standards that the court has applied, the expert witness in this case did not comply with the foundations of Daubert.
First, corroborating that was the evidence with regard to what he said about cutting off a victim's hands. And here that was done.
In this case, the victim's hands were cut off. Yes, that's correct, Judge.
And he discussed why that should be because of, as I recall, the O.J. Simpson matter and underneath the fingernails and all that sort of thing.
It was brought in, Judge, by a witness who testified that, and I can't even remember the circumstances that arose under, but yes, he did. A witness was brought in and said, I was told by Mr. Hartman that
he was in jail with him, or he was a friend or something.
I think he was a friend that he worked with, if I remember the record correctly, Judge. Obviously, under Daubert, there's a need to establish the credibility of a witness, whether or not the technique is proper. In this case, we don't have anything at all to establish the proper technique. We don't have anything to show that there was an error rate in this case for this. Once again, we have the problems of the fingerprinting itself. There is no error rate for fingerprints Unlike DNA, where you have a basis, a scientific basis for what is said and what is done, you don't have that with fingerprinting. And that was
excuse me, counsel. Did this expert also make the comparison of the fingerprint without digital enhancement and make the same, come to the same conclusion, Warwick? Did he?
That is correct. As I had indicated earlier, he did make the conclusion that it was, he indicated that he had come to that conclusion without the digital enhancement, but as I had indicated to Justice Stranton, I'm not sure if that was made before or after he had done the digital enhancement in this case. So I'm not, it was in the record, but I'm not sure, like I said, when it came out. As I indicated, under where you have things such as DNA evidence, where you can establish a basis for the expert testimony, you have a reliability factor. Here you don't have that. Unfortunately, with fingerprinting, you don't have someone who can say, well, I've done a comparison or I've done a study, and it is established that this person or this amount of people or X amount of people will have a rich comparison as to fingerprints. You also look to whether there are objective standards to govern the technique, and in this case, once again, we don't have any objective standards because, as a witness testified, this was the first time that he had ever done this technique before. Finally, under Daubert, there's an indication of a standard that there is to be a reliance on other publications, other experts in this field. And once again, due to the newness of this area, and as I indicated, this individual had never testified in this before, we don't have that in this case. That was the issue that I had planned on raising with the court. If there are other issues that the court or propositions of law that the court wants me to go into, I will be happy. Otherwise, I will reserve the time for any rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. Mr. Bogdanoff.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Philip Bogdanoff. I represent the state of Ohio. Mr. Sugarman's attempt to compare this case to the previous case regarding the fact that this case was supplemented at the grand jury for death specifications, first of all, is not raised in his brief, is not assigned as an assignment of error. I was unaware that that happened until it was brought up at oral argument. But mainly, I can tell you without hesitation that the Beacon Journal did not request that this case be brought in for a death specification. And I can tell you the Beacon Journal does not ever editorialize that charges should be increased for whatever reason. The Beacon asked the prosecutor to dismiss cases or not to retry cases. I don't know why that is, but I don't think you'll ever see a case from Akron, Ohio, that is similar to the case that you just heard. The defendant makes essentially two arguments in his first assignment of error. First, he says that there's no evidence of kidnapping. I disagree with that. In this case, you have photos which show that the victim's left leg is tied to the bedpost. That is evidence of restraint. There's also evidence of her left ankle, which shows bruising. The coroner testified that that would also be indicative of some type of possible restraint. And also the jury could make that inference even without the coroner's testimony. He also indicated that there was bruising on the right leg. So the jury could certainly infer that she was tied up on the right leg also.
I'm looking for where you make the... where you find that it's not incidental to the murder, Mr. Bachman.
And that goes,
if you're going to stab someone 138 times, they're going to have to stay still.
Exactly, Your Honor. And I believe that point was brought up by Justice Stratton, that it would take a significant amount of time for that to occur.
Well, do you think that alone meets the standard for not being incidental to the murder?
Well, Your Honor, I looked at State versus Logan, which was a case that first spoke about merger under 2941.25, and what Logan held is, number one, there would not be merger if the restraint was prolonged or the confinement was secretive, and that was in the conjunctive, so it's either or. Here, the confinement was secretive. I mean, she was brutalized and stabbed 135 times in the apartment building, and nobody knew about it. When they interviewed everybody in the apartment, nobody would testify that you heard any screams. And the reason being is that she had a gag in her mouth while she was being stabbed, so nobody could hear her screams. That is evidence that the confinement was secretive. So you don't have to reach the point the defense counsel is arguing. All you need to find is the confinement is secretive under Logan, or the restraint was prolonged. And there is evidence of the fact that the restraint was prolonged, because it does take time to stab somebody 135 times and then cut off their hands. There was also evidence that she was strangled because there was petechiae in her eyes. This took substantial amount of time. And I think this court indicated in State versus Simcoe, 1.5 hour was a substantial amount of time in order to avoid the merger issue.
So any time that some sadistic person decides on a course of conduct to torture someone in the process of a murder, in other words, they decide, I'm not just going to murder this person, I'm going to make them feel maximum pain in this process, you therefore then have a kidnapping case.
I'm not saying that, Your Honor, because in this case, what you are looking at is the restraint.
I think that was the point of Justice Cook's question, is could there not be two views of this restraint? The other view, the one you have, is it's kidnapping. The other view being it's part of a course of conduct, which was to just brutally murder this woman. And that's what it was all about. The tying up the legs was so he could accomplish this in a slow and brutal and painful fashion.
Well, I, as opposed to keying in on the torture, I am looking at the restraint and applying the Logan test. And what I believe is the restraint is prolonged, then you meet the test of Logan. Not so much a torture, but the restraint. And how do we know she was restrained for a long period of time in that she was cut 135 times? She was also beaten severely about the head. And in order to accomplish that, I think the logical inference to be drawn is that she was restrained and that her left ankle was tied to the bedpost while he was cutting her. So I'm not keying on a torture, and I disagree with that statement. Every time you have torture, you would have kidnapping. What I am keying on is the restraint. And you also look at the testimony of Brian Tyson, who was an inmate. The defendant made the statement to Mr. Tyson that he used cords to tie her up. So there would be more evidence of the fact that she was restrained while this stabbing occurred. And that's the only thing I am looking at. Number one, was the restraint prolonged? And number two, was the confinement secretive under Logan? And if you meet either of those criteria, then you have a separate animus for the kidnapping. And I think in this case, you meet both of those criteria, because the restraint was prolonged and the confinement was secretive. Therefore, applying the rationale of Logan, you would find a separate animus for these offenses. Moving to the next issue that was raised by defense counsel, which was ineffective assistance of counsel. I think when you look at the opening statement of Mr. Whitney, In the mitigation phase, you have to look at his entire statement. And what defense counsel has done is taken out two sentences of his entire closing argument in order to argue that he was ineffective. I would like to put those two sentences into context. And remember, this is the opening argument during the mitigation, not the closing argument. This is his beginning of the opening argument. May it please the court, Mr. Coombs, Ms. Bandy, Ms. Dougherty. Mitigating factors are those factors that, while they do not justify or excuse a crime, nevertheless, in fairness and mercy, may not be considered or may be considered by you. While they do not justify or excuse in fairness and mercy, they may be considered by you. By presenting the social history, if you will, of Brett Hartman, we're not trying to justify. We're not trying to reduce blame because you've already determined blame. You've already said that Brett Hartman is guilty of this murder. There's nothing I can do, nothing we can say, no evidence we can put on to reduce the blame that you've already ascribed. What we're asking, what the law asks us to do at this point of the trial, is to present to you other factors that you haven't heard. Some of these you've given. You have some kind of flavor for. I think you knew that he had an alcohol problem. You have to be from Mars not to know that. And then the court, then defense counsel goes on to explain why they should look at the other mitigating factors. And in his closing, he comes back to the mitigating factors. So I think you need to look at both the opening and the closing in determining whether or not counsel was ineffective when making the statements to the jury. And I believe that counsel did an excellent job in this case with what he had to work with. He presented the arguments he could, presented them effectively, and did a very good job of it. There are at least two other arguments of ineffective assistance of counsel that are presented before this court where defense counsel has misstated the record, and I want to bring it up to this court even though they were not separately argued by defense counsel here. He indicates at one point in time that defense counsel did not object to Rod Englert's testimony. If you look at transcript page 1476, there is an objection when Mr. Englert gives his opinion based upon reasonable medical certainty regarding the blood splatter. Defense counsel before this court indicates there was no objection. Also, he indicates counsel was ineffective for not objecting to Mr. Warwick's testimony, the fingerprint expert. Again, when you examine the record, there is an objection by defense counsel, and later on, he explains the basis for his objection in that the opinion was not based on reasonable scientific certainty. So I believe that those arguments by defense counsel are not valid because trial counsel did raise those objections before the trial court. Moving to the next assignment of error that was argued by defense counsel, which was Mr. Warwick's testimony regarding the fingerprint analysis. Again, I would strongly suggest that this court find that even if there were error, it was not prejudicial to defendant. As Justice Stratton pointed out, the defendant admitted to being at the crime scene. He admitted to trying to clean up the crime scene. His fingerprints, he admits, would be all over the crime scene, and he tried to wipe off as many as he could. So where is the prejudice in this case? Even if the testimony was not properly admitted because of the defendant's statements, repeated statements, that he was at the crime scene, there simply is no prejudice to the defendant. I would certainly like to indicate to this court that this evidence was properly presented. Unfortunately, I cannot do that. I would certainly like to see some case law from the court indicating that this testimony where you have fingerprint enhancement is acceptable. Unfortunately, the record is not as good as it could be. The question was not asked of Mr. Warwick whether or not it was based on scientific certainty. It should have been. But he did set forth the procedure that he used in examining the fingerprints. And what he indicated is that he scanned, they took a photograph, a digital photograph of the fingerprint. It was a thumbprint that was found on the bedspread. They took a photograph of that, scanned it into a computer, and based on a computer program, they were able to have a digital image. And what they did with that digital image was to basically change the colors in order to make it more distinctive and easier to compare. He did not create anything. Basically, what they were doing is changing the color pixels on the fingerprint in order to be able to observe it better and make better comparisons. So based on that testimony, I do not believe that there was any prejudicial error to defendant by admitting the expert opinion of the fingerprint expert. He did testify that this was the first time he had ever testified regarding fingerprint digitalization. However, he did also state that they have been doing it in Seattle, Washington for a year and a half. So this was not new technology that he was using. He had used it before, but it was the first time he ever had ever testified regarding this technology.
And it has been sanctioned by the highest court of that state.
There was no testimony on that, Your Honor.
Okay.
What he did testify was the first time he ever had used it in court, so I cannot state that. Mm-hmm. And I guess
the case books show it.
The case, all right. I did not know that. Lastly, Your Honor, those are the arguments that were covered by the defendant. The one argument that I would like to touch upon would be the jury instructions at mitigation. The defendant argued that the state did not include purpose on the instruction regarding kidnapping. And they are correct. What the instruction should have read would be that the person was restrained with purpose to facilitate the commission of the felony. In this case, the trial judge in the mitigation indicated that the person was restrained to facilitate, leaving out the purposeful element. But I do not believe that there would be any prejudicial error to the defendant. In reality, it's basically raising the bar for the state to show that when he did the restraint, he actually did it in order to facilitate the murder or to inflict serious physical harm, as opposed to just having the purpose. So I do not believe that the instruction, although it was incorrect, in any way prejudiced the defendant. I believe that's the sum and substance of anything that I have. If the court has any questions, I would certainly respond to any questions the court has.
Thank you, Mr. Bauchner.
Thank you.
Mr. Sugarman, you've saved a little over 9 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I find it very interesting and very instructive that Mr. Bogdanoff refers to the Logan case, because the facts in Logan are exactly what I'm talking about. In fact, they're much more difficult in the Logan case. And in our brief, we have recited those facts, and I think it bears repeating. In Logan, the defendant, with a knife pressed to the victim's throat, forced her into an alley. The victim accompanied the defendant down the alley, around the corner, and down a flight of stairs where the defendant raped her at knife point. Immediately after the rape, the defendant released her. Given this set of facts, the court held that the detention and asportation of the victim was incidental to the crime of rape and therefore demonstrates but a single animus. That is our case here. I want to get back a little bit, if I can, to the mitigation, and I want to talk about Brett Hartman and some of the mitigating factors this morning. The the part in the state's brief that bothered me the most was that they referred to the comments, the opening statement that was made by trial counsel as an elegant concession. We have now, in the state of Ohio, begun to execute people involuntarily. So we're not making elegant concessions at penalty stages of death penalty cases. We must be diligent in ensuring that the defendants are afforded every opportunity to convince that lone juror that this case that this court talked about in Brooks. All we needed to convince was one lone juror that Brett Hartman did not deserve the death penalty, and perhaps the result would have been different. He was not afforded that opportunity. And there are a couple of other matters that I think are important as to the ineffective assistance of counsel. Number one, in our brief, we've attached a report of Dr. James Siddle, who's a psychologist. And as I read through it again in preparation for this argument, and I'll discuss some of the mitigating factors, I don't understand why that report was not submitted to the jury, because it detailed about a dozen mitigating factors that could have been utilized and should have been utilized. And in addition, there was no expert on alcoholism that was retained. Brett was 23 years old at the time this crime was committed. The reports and the arguments and the evidence show that there was a terrible childhood, that he lived in many different with many different relatives, and that there was step-parent abuse involved. He ran away at a very young age, and this kid went into an alcoholic coma and was hospitalized at the age of 12 years old. And from 12 years old to 23, he accumulated a record of five DUIs, and the alcohol and the alcoholism and the drug use permeated his very existence. In fact, when you read the testimony, his day consisted of going to work and getting drunk and getting up and going to work and getting drunk, and that was it. And for there not to be this report by Siddle, Dr. Siddle, and for there not to be an alcoholism expert that was at least submitted to this jury in some type of mitigation, I believe falls far below the standard, the objective standard of care that a defense counsel must use in presenting this argument to the jury. I believe that there are mitigating factors. We have detailed them in the brief. I believe that they outweigh the mitigating factor in this case, which was the kidnapping. And it is, I think, by the questions that you've asked me and asked the state today, a pretty tenuous charge here. And I ask this court to, based on the record and based on the arguments, to vacate the death penalty in this particular case and remand this matter for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Sugarman.
Thank
the case
you.
Is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.